I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times in Review, our Friday show when we dig into the archives and find some of the best interviews from Radio Times past. First up on today's show, we revisit my conversation with author and Army veteran Wes Moore. He joined me in 2010 to discuss his book, The Other Wes Moore, One Name, Two Fates. The book juxtaposes the lives of two Baltimore natives named Wes Moore. One, our guest, went on to be an Oxford Rhodes Scholar, decorated soldier, and White House fellow, and the other, who was sentenced to life in federal prison. The book is an examination of the influences that shape our lives. Let's listen. Tell us about this neighborhood in Baltimore where you and the other Wes Moore grew up. I should add that you later moved to the Bronx. But nonetheless, describe what this neighborhood was like.
Well, you know, when Wes was actually arrested, Wes was actually just living, you know, blocks away from me. Even when I was learning about Wes through these different newspaper articles, I was very familiar with the neighborhoods that he called home, with the areas that he called home. And he moved quite a bit when he was younger. But it's an area where you have a lot of challenges. It's an area where there's a lot of economic disparities, an area where, you know, the majority of homes are female-run homes, and you don't have many fathers or male role models who are around there. And you have a lot of the challenges that you see in so many both urban and rural communities, particularly poor urban and rural communities within the United States. And so as I learned more about Wes's story and then also then forced myself to learn more about my own, you realize just how the neighborhoods and the environments play into some of the decisions that a lot of young people will make.
Your mom was a single mom after her husband, your father, died, and she decided to move to the Bronx and to move essentially to be closer to family up there. How significant was that for you, do you think?
I think it was incredibly important. I think my mother was having a lot of difficulties after my father died. Here she was now, and in an instant, again, completely unprepared, in an instant, she became a widow in her late 20s, now with three children. And I think she was having a lot of transition difficulties in terms of not only just taking care of us, but just more importantly, taking care of herself. So she decided to move us up to the Bronx where my grandparents were. My grandparents had moved to the United States. My grandfather was actually raised in Jamaica. My grandmother was born in Cuba. And they'd moved to the United States just decades before because of the ministry. My grandfather actually became the first black minister in the history of the Dutch Reformed Church.
Oh, is that right?
And was a minister in the Bronx. My grandmother was a school teacher. And we moved into their small home up in the Bronx. All four of us decided to, move up there. And I think it was really important for me in terms of now my mother had more support. I think she wanted it because she had more people in the house now who could help her with this transition. She had my grandfather there, and she knew that she wanted a male role model inside of the house, which was really important to her. I also think, though, that as I moved up, that was also the area that I started really grappling with this concept of manhood and what that meant and what I was supposed to be. And I think that's where a lot of challenges and difficulties also started to really show themselves out as we made the transition from Maryland up into the Bronx.
And I do want to get to that, but let me go back to the other Wes Moore and his mother, who you write about, Mary. She was the first in her family to begin college. She has, as you describe, she had dreams as a young woman growing up in Baltimore.
She did. I mean, Mary had always wanted to be an entrepreneur or have her own business and was moving towards that. She was actually, as you said, the first one to graduate from college. She graduated from Baltimore City Community College and then was later accepted to Johns Hopkins University and was all prepared and set to go. And then her funding got cut out from under her. So she was forced to leave school, and she has never taken any more college classes after that. And she went to go be a unit secretary. It was one of the things that really hit me as I was doing research. I'd done over 200 hours of research for this book and with Wes and his friends and family and my friends and family. And you just think about how different life could have been, not just for Mary, but for her family, for her kids. Had she been able to complete her education, had she been able to get that degree, I can't help but imagine, had she had the chance to actually get a degree from Johns Hopkins University, had she made the connections and networks that she would have made at Johns Hopkins University, how life could have been different for both her and all the children that she was raising at that point.
But was there an extended family? Was there a support system? Because it sounds like you had that.
I did, and I was extraordinarily fortunate to have that, to have my grandparents there, and I had uncles and aunts who were around to really help support my mother when she needed it. Wes had it to an extent. I don't think he had it to the same level. He had aunts, he has one aunt in particular that was really almost like a second mother to him as he was growing up, and he stayed with her quite a bit. But also, I think the other challenge was that because West didn't have a lot of those, you know, formalized systems and positive models around him, he really looked to people who really had no business teaching him anything. In many cases, Wes's main role model was his older brother, Tony, never went to school past eighth grade, was involved in the drug game in Baltimore from the time he was around 10 years old. And Tony, by the time he was, you know, barely in his teens, had a pretty fearful reputation around town about who he was and the type of things that he would do. And that really became the person that Wes tried to model himself after. And interestingly enough, Tony was also spent a lot of his time, particularly in the young years, trying to keep Wes away, trying to keep Wes out of the drug game, trying to keep Wes in school and doing the right thing, because Tony understood that that game is something that's a very slippery slope. And once you get involved in it, it becomes very difficult to break free. And Wes didn't heed his lesson.
I also noticed in the early pictures of the other Wes Moore that, he looks like a regular kid, if I can say that. And he has kind of a happy expression. But later on in those pictures as an adult, there is a kind of deadness coming from his eyes.
There is. And that's really the unfortunate thing, is that we look at the final result. And, we see Wes now is, in his mid-30s, and he's not just a father, but he's a grandfather. And he's in the 10th year of a life sentence. He's going to spend the rest of his life in prison. And he's going to spend the rest of his life in prison for the murder of a hero, for a 13-year veteran of the police force who was a father of five and had triplets. And the reason he was working was because he was trying to make extra money for his family. You see that final result, but, we forget about the child that was there before and what could have happened and the lack of intervention in the child's life that eventually created what we now have today. And it's really unfortunate, and it's a real tragedy when we think about not obviously the loss of the police officer's life, but in many ways the decisions that led to that and what ended up happening that created the life that made those decisions.
As you say, you were not a perfect child, and you've certainly felt the lure of the streets, but something intervened, something stopped you. What do you think that was?
Well, it's true, and that's one thing I had to be very honest with myself and about my own past as I decided to write this book was, my life has not been perfect by any stretch of the imagination. By the time I was, a preteen, I was already on academic and disciplinary probation at school. I was placed in the back of a police car for tagging or vandalism by the time I was 12 years old, and I was sent away to military school at Valley Forge
outside
Pennsylvania.
Of Philly.
And I had a mandatory year there. And I hated it when I first went there. I ran away, five times in the first 4 days as I first got to this military school. But I think it was a place where that allowed me to not just change my physical environment, but to change my psychological environment, where I started to think more about what I wanted from life and the type of man that I wanted to be. And I felt like I was part of something bigger than myself. And that, I think, really helped to motivate me and inspire me to want to do more. Once I got some leadership and I got some rank and I was now in charge of people and I realized my life mattered, that's when I think I really started to make a turn and start to make a change.
Let me go back to this school that your mom sent you to. It was called Riverdale Country School. When she moved you and the family to the Bronx, I guess the idea that she wanted, a better school for you?
That's exactly right. I think she came back to the Bronx with the understanding that the Bronx was really more like the neighborhood that she grew up in. And I think she immediately noticed that she came back that, the Bronx during the 1980s was going through a significant transition. I think you started seeing the influx of crack cocaine into the community. You started seeing a lot more violence inside of the neighborhoods. And my mother made a decision pretty early on, as soon as we got back home, that this was not going to work. She was not going to send her kids to school inside the neighborhood. So she started thinking about other options and ended up working multiple jobs in order to send me to a school in Riverdale, which is just on the other side of the Bronx, but really a beautiful school and almost like a college preparatory school for kids. But I think it also increasingly became a place that I got very lost, because I felt like I was almost straddling these different worlds as I was personally going through the process of my own evolution into manhood. And so I found myself increasingly becoming too rich for the kids in the neighborhood who didn't know why I had to go all the way across town to go to school, and too poor for the kids in school. And so it really left me almost in the middle, in my own little island there, which I think really led to itself. It led itself into making a lot of bad decisions, because I was simply looking for acceptance. I was looking for some group to accept me in, and I realized I wasn't comfortable in my own skin anywhere that I was.
Were you lonely?
I was very lonely. I felt like no one really could understand my situation. At least I continued to tell myself that. And I think that loneliness helped play itself out in a lot of the bad decisions that I ended up making.
I'm thinking about the other Wes Moore and whether the street, the drug trade provided the same thing for him that you got through military school.
Absolutely.
Connection, belonging, people that were sort of, quote unquote, there for you.
And, you know, my mother always says something which I think is really accurate. Is she says, kids need to think that you care before they care what you think. Mm-hmm. And I think that's absolutely right. And I think in so many cases for so many kids, and I think Wes's story is a good example of this, when kids are looking around and looking for that acceptance, they'll look for anyone who's willing to give it to them. And if the positive role models and the positive examples aren't there to provide that level of acceptance and that level of understanding about this journey that they're going through, the corner boys will. The guys in the corners will. The guys in the gangs will. And they will provide that level of quote-unquote love and support and concern that so many young people are looking for, and that's why they become such easy recruits for that kind of life.
And he ends up being part of a group of people that murders this Sergeant Prothero, and he was working as an off-duty security guard, as you said, trying to raise extra money to raise a family, and he's killed in a robbery just outside of Baltimore.
Absolutely. This is a gentleman who was a father. He did nothing wrong besides go to work that day. And four guys walked into the jewelry store, two guys with guns, two guys with mallets, and they got everybody on the ground. And the two guys with mallets proceeded to walk around the jewelry store and smash cases and take out over $400,000 worth of jewelry. You know, one of them said, "Let's go." They ran out of the store, and Sergeant Prothero went after them to try to stop them, to try to keep this crime from happening, to try to keep them from getting away. And as he went outside, he was, you know, shot three times and murdered senselessly by these four gentlemen. And Wes, his older brother, and two other guys were all convicted of felony murder for that brutal crime.
And sitting in prison, life without parole.
All four got life without parole, yes.
Now, you began this correspondence with him once you learned about this other Wes Moore who had lived such a different life from yours. And you had some questions for him. What did you want to know from this other Wes Moore before you got to actually know him?
You know, it's interesting because I had so many, I mean, just the whole story that I learned about it just kept haunting me. And I just kept thinking about, how did this happen? How did two guys who have similar backgrounds and similar situations in life come to completely different destinies? And one day I decided to write him a note. And I wrote him this letter just basically asking him a series of questions. Like, I knew he had children from the articles I read. So I asked him, does he ever see his kids? And I asked him, does he ever see his brother? Because I knew his brother was also convicted for the crime. And I wasn't sure if I'd hear back from him. And quite honestly, it didn't matter if I heard back from him, because I knew that at least if I wrote the letter, then I would feel good, like I did my part. I couldn't control if he wrote me back. And a month after I wrote him that note, I get a letter back, an envelope from Jessup Correctional Institution from Wes Moore. And that was really what began the correspondence. That one letter turned into dozens of letters, and those dozens of letters have turned into dozens of visits, and that really served as the backbone and the foundation of the larger story that we try to tell.
And that was my interview with Wes Moore about his book, The Other Wes Moore, One Name, Two Fates. He has a new book out called The Work, My Search for a Life That Matters. When we get back, we'll hear my conversation about an unlikely group of activists who discovered the depths of J. Edgar Hoover's secret surveillance program. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Tonight, the Bryn Mawr Film Institute will premiere a new documentary called 1971. The film, which is co-executive produced by recent Academy Award winner Laura Poitras, chronicles the activist group that called themselves the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI. The group broke into the FBI's Media Pennsylvania offices and uncovered J. Edgar Hoover's program called COINTELPRO. It was an illegal surveillance program that used strong-arm tactics to infiltrate and discredit domestic political organizations. The group sent their findings to then-Washington Post reporter Betty Metzger, who published their story. The activists never got caught, and their efforts eventually resulted in the first congressional investigation of U.S. intelligence agencies. I spoke with Betty Metzger about this story last year, and we were joined by two members of the motley band of whistleblowers, Bonnie and John Raines. Metzger had just published a book about this extraordinary tale called The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI. Let's listen. Let me begin with you, Bonnie. Has it been hard to keep this secret for more than 40 years?
Not
really, we agreed that once we delivered the documents and hoped to see the outcome that we wanted to see, that we would just return to our regular lives, and we were not going to talk about it with anyone whatsoever.
I assume you talked about it with each other.
Well, we stayed up a few nights about it.
Especially the first 5 years.
And why the first 5 years? Well, in part because you were being investigated, or
Oh, yes. The
FBI was looking for you.
200 agents were looking for us.
Betty, let me get you in on the conversation. You received some of these stolen documents. What was your first reaction?
Well, my first reaction was surprise and a little bit of shock. That's because the first file that I read was one that was a policy statement that one could hardly believe. It was a statement that said agents should enhance paranoia and also that agents should make it appear that there's an FBI agent behind every mailbox. I thought that was a pretty extreme statement.
And these were statements from the FBI, part of these documents that you then, read through and used as some of your reporting for the Washington Post at the time.
Right. The burglars sent out the files, a new set of files, every 10 days to 2 weeks for a period of about 2 months.
And was there any hesitation at the Washington Post, because you didn't know who was sending them to you, was there any hesitation about publishing some of this material?
There was. What happened was the main concern when I finished reading the documents, it was clear that this was important information that the public needed to know, and the editors at the Post agreed with that. And we fortunately had confirmation from the Attorney General, John Mitchell, that the documents were authentic, copies of ones that had been stolen from the media office. And then he spent the afternoon calling two of the editors plus publisher Catherine Graham, demanding that they not publish. Mm. The House counsel also advised that. But fortunately, by 10 o'clock that night, Catherine Graham made the decision to publish, and the story ran in the Post the next day, and the same story, by the way, on the front of the Philadelphia Inquirer. It was the first time that a journalist had received secret government documents from a source outside government, as opposed to an inside whistleblower who had stolen the files. It was also the first time that the Nixon administration demanded that Catherine Graham suppress a story.
But she didn't, obviously.
She did not, and she had much practice later on.
Yes, indeed. It kind of set the stage for what was to come. Let me go back to you, John, and Bonnie Raines, and even talk about Philadelphia at the time. We're talking about late 60s, early 70s. I would say I describe you as activist. Bonnie, would that be a pretty apt description of you at the time?
Oh, yes. Beginning with the Civil Rights Movement, John in particular was a freedom rider. And then when we moved to Philadelphia, we found a whole community of activists here that we affiliated with. And our first real action was with a group of people who were resisting the draft, that so-called Catholic left. And we participated in a draft board raid where we went in the middle of the night and removed draft files and destroyed them.
Mm. Were you, and I'm curious about whether you, John, and others part of this group, did you know that the FBI was surveilling you? Was it about suspicions that there was surveillance going on?
Well, my experience with the FBI, and I always say J. Edgar Hoover's FBI, because that's very important to realize that J. Edgar Hoover was head of the FBI for almost five decades. He was the most powerful man in Washington. He was more powerful than presidents. They come at 4 or 8 years. And he was able to mold that large institution according to his own biases. So that my first experience of J. Edgar Hoover and his FBI was really down south in the Civil Rights Movement. I was a freedom rider in 1961, part of Mississippi Freedom Summer in 64, and was on the Selma March in 65. And it was very clear for those of us involved in the Civil Rights Movement that J. Edgar Hoover wanted to suppress that movement. He wanted the streets quiet. He wanted the protest ended. And he used all of his power to try to do that. And luckily, of course, he failed and freedom won. Now, we brought that kind of experience north into the anti-war movement. It was clear to those of us in that war movement, anti-war movement, that there were literally hundreds of FBI agents taking pictures of us everywhere, listening to our telephones, sandbagging our mail and so on. But we had no evidence. We only had our experience, and that's led us to what we did.
That FBI that John accurately refers to as J. Edgar Hoover's FBI started in 1924 when Hoover was 29 years old. And so by the time they burglarized the media office in 1971 and opened the door, literally, not only to that office, but then opened the door to the FBI generally, that kind of activity, political spying and dirty tricks operations, had been going on for a half century.
Let me turn to you, Bonnie, because I know one of the things that you did, I guess, in anticipation of breaking into the FBI office and media was to go there, I guess, posing as a young person interested in what?
Well, we had gathered all the information called casing up to that point about the outside of the building and the activities in and out of the building. But we needed to get inside the office during business hours to learn about the layout of the office. So I was recruited to pose as a Swarthmore College student and ask for an interview because I said I was doing research on opportunities for women in the FBI. And they gave me a time for an interview, and I disguised my appearance as best I could and went in and had enough time, maybe 45 minutes, to really scope out the entire office and to see that there were no security systems whatsoever. The file cabinets were not locked. So that gave us the information that we really needed to move ahead.
John, had you ever burgled an office or a building or an apartment or anything in your past?
Oh, yes. We were both members, Bonnie and I were both members of the East Coast Conspiracy to Save Lives. That was the Berrigan Brothers group. And we learned our burglary skills from priests and nuns who turned out to be very good teachers.
And you're not being sarcastic here.
No, I'm not. This is literal truth, yeah.
But did you have hesitation? I mean, there must have been some hesitation because you were breaking the law.
Well, there was a lot of hesitation, mostly because we're parents at the time. We had three children under 10. That gave us a very considerable kind of thoughtful pause before we committed to the burglary. We were pretty confident in our burglary skills. We had done the casing, as Bonnie indicated, very carefully. Bonnie had gone in and discovered that there was no internal security and that the doors were fairly simple to get into. Still, as the time for the burglary approached, I, more than Bonnie, curiously enough, began to be very worried.
Because of your children?
Because of my children, and because I knew that J. Edgar Hoover would throw everything he had at us. And he had a lot. He had 200 agents put on our case, and they flooded the Philadelphia area. Lucky for us, the Philadelphia area was the national center back then, in the late 60s, early 70s, of the anti-war movement. There were literally thousands of activists opposing that war here in this area. Mm. There was a whole ocean, so to speak, with many, many fish in it. And we could, after the robbery, we could disappear and meld in with all those fish.
Were you less worried, Bonnie, because what, you were confident it would happen or you just put this out of your mind?
Well, I had a great deal of confidence in our leader, Bill Davidon, who was a very smart, strategic, careful person. We took all the necessary steps to be prepared for any contingency. And we were it was a tight-knit group of people with common values, and we were very committed and careful. So I was quite confident. I don't think cocky exactly, but confident.
But it seems to me that this group was taking a great risk. They may have felt confident, but still a great risk in breaking into the FBI office.
It was an enormous risk. Bill Davidon had become convinced by late 1970 that if the government was suppressing dissent, which he by then thought it was, he thought that's a crime against democracy, and it's a crime that has to be stopped. And it was that kind of commitment that they had, that this was, if dissent was so precious, that if it was occurring, it was important enough to risk your freedom for many years. So that's an extraordinary kind of commitment.
Bonnie, let me go back to you. I mean, do you feel like there was nothing else you could have done besides break into this office?
That's how we felt. It began to feel like it was a citizen's responsibility to stand up to Hoover and to reveal important threats to democracy. And we felt we were entitled to do that because we were citizens who were concerned about his threats and his methods.
And what did it take, John, to get inside this office? I know there was some plans to get in that were derailed a bit. It was a little more secure getting in the door than you thought it was going to be.
Yes. Well, one of us had practiced to become a locksmith. And he was the person who was going to pick the lock on the main door and get us in. Unfortunately, when he got there, the lock was a very sophisticated lock, more sophisticated than he had thought, and he could not get into that door. Bonnie had discovered when she was inside that there was a second door, but in front of that door there was a very large metal cabinet. So what had to happen was when Keith couldn't open the first door, he phoned back to Bill Davidan and others. And Bill was very firm here. He said, well, let's try the other door. Sure enough, he could get the second door open, but there was a dead bolt, and he had to use a crowbar. Oh. Now, luckily, it was during the fight. Ali and Fraser were on the radio, and the fight was going on. And so any noise that came from the office for the people upstairs, the apartment people, or the super whose apartment was directly below the FBI office, they were distracted.
Well, and did you choose a date knowing that there would be this big fight,
yes.
Muhammad Ali and,
yes.
and Joe Frazier? Yes, mm-hmm. Bonnie, you say?
Yes, we did. We also thought that the police might be a little distracted and perhaps a little more lax in their patrols because they would be listening to the fight as well.
And, I mean, I'm assuming that this was an office full of documents. Did you know what you were looking for, Bonnie?
We had a pretty strong hunch that we would find something concrete. Because the FBI is such a bureaucracy, everything goes into their written records. But it was a hunch, and we really didn't know for sure until we removed all the documents and then had a chance to sort through them to see what we had.
And was there one, or I mean, were there ones that you just felt like, this is what we're looking for?
It didn't take very long
really?
To find what Keith referred to as the gold, the gold in the documents, and very clear language about illegal surveillance.
I mean, you knew it was illegal at the time?
Yes, we did. Definitely First Amendment material.
Betty, let me go back to you. And as you have referenced earlier in the interview, you received this packet of documents from this anonymous citizens organization.
The Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI. That's what the burglars named themselves. And that's exactly what they did in a far deeper ways than they probably thought possible, both for themselves right. and then what they made possible for others to do later.
And why you, Betty?
Better to ask them that. I had no idea since I didn't know who they were at the time.
So why Betty Metzger, John?
Well, Betty had been here in Philadelphia. She was a religion editor for the Bulletin when that paper was still in publication. And from those days, we knew her. We knew that she'd gone down to the Washington Post, where she was the religion editor there. So she was one of the five that we sent these documents to. As it turned out, the Washington Post was the only one of the five that, in fact, decided to publish these. The New York Times did not publish it. The L.A. Times did not publish. The two progressive political persons that we sent them to immediately turned all of those files back to the FBI.
And we should say one of them was Senator George McGovern.
Yes, that's right.
And the other, Representative Perrin Mitchell from Baltimore.
That's mm-hmm. right.
Were you surprised that they gave the information back to the FBI?
I was.
Dismayed, I think, would be a better way to say it.
Betty, you have a pretty interesting story because for years you did not know who this group was. And you were, it sounds like you were having dinner at our guest house a couple of years ago. And you realized these were the people that had sent you these documents.
Yeah, well, John blurted out a comment that made it pretty clear.
Without thinking about it.
By that time, I was in California, and I was visiting Philadelphia and seeing people who were acquaintances from the years when I worked there, and I spent the first evening at dinner with John and Bonnie. When their daughter, whom I had never met, came into the room, John suggested that they'd like for her to know me better because many years ago when they had information about the FBI that they thought the American public should know, they gave it to me. And I was astonished. I never had any idea. I never tried to find out, not that I think I could have, but from the beginning, once I knew those documents were authentic, my emphasis entirely was on the substance of them, which I thought was very important, rather than who had stolen them.
Well, Bonnie, let me go back to you, and just I want our listeners to understand, once this went public and the Washington Post began publishing some of these stories, the FBI really swarmed into the Philadelphia area looking for you and your co-conspirators, if I can use that.
Yes, they did swarm, 200 of them. And the story is that Hoover yelled at his agents, "Find me that woman," because they figured out that the connection. And so mine was the only face that they knew. And so there was a sketch of me that was being circulated, apparently. But as we said before, there were so many other possible suspects, and they kept sort of barking up the wrong trees in terms of others who'd gone into other draft boards or some of those other activities. So that was important in terms of our not being caught.
And the statute of limitations was, what, 5 years?
5 years. Mm-hmm.
So after 5 years, you...
We relaxed a little bit.
Betty, did the federal government know anything about the extent of the kind of surveillance and infiltration that was happening under the aegis of J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI?
Hoover kept most of these elements of his programming, and especially COINTELPRO, secret within the Bureau. And they weren't even known to attorney generals who were his bosses, but few, if any, were. Robert Kennedy tried. And presidents, most presidents didn't know either.
Was the goal then to shed light on what the FBI was doing, to bring in some kind of reforms and controls over this agency?
Of course. The problem was nobody in Washington that had an official position was going to do this. Nobody was going to hold J. Edgar Hoover and his FBI accountable. And we faced a situation where you had an out-of-control, very powerful man, an out-of-control, very powerful institution in Washington that Washington would not bring within control, would not make responsible. So it was left to we, the citizens. I mean, and the bottom line is that we're the last line of defense. The average citizen is the last line of defense when it comes to freedom, and that will be true until the end of our nation.
That was my 2014 interview with journalist Betty Metzger and activists John and Bonnie Raines, who helped uncover and expose an illegal surveillance program of J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. A documentary about these events premieres tonight at the Bryn Mawr Film Institute. When we get back from the break, we'll hear from pun champion John Pollock. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoane. Last Wednesday was National Pun Day. So to commemorate the occasion, we're going to listen back to my conversation with pun champion and former presidential speechwriter John Pollock. He joined me in the studio back in 2011 to discuss his book, The Pun Also Rises, How the Humble Pun Revolutionized Language, Changed History, and Made Wordplay More Than Some Antics. Let's listen. I have to confess here that my husband puns. I can see his mind taking words and turning them upside down or taking phrases and turning them around. Is that what you do?
Yes. I've often described the way my brain works with language and puns as being like those old train departure boards or airplane departure boards at the old airports, and that the little pieces are constantly flicking around, and then they find their order, and you've got a new word there.
And that's what you do?
And that's what I do. But I do that with sounds. And so I'm breaking apart words for their component sounds and then playing around and reassembling them into new combinations.
And are you doing that while we're talking right now?
No, because I've only got one brain to work with. But at the pun contest, at the pun championships, one needs to do that. You need to listen with one ear and think with the other half of your brain.
Well, you even talk about some of the research that's been done, even MRI research, to look at obviously the language parts of the brain. Is there something unique, do you think, about a punster's brain?
I think that all people have the capacity to pun. In fact, we see punning take place across such diverse cultures, from the Tzotzil speakers of the Chiapas Highlands in southern Mexico to Chinese bloggers today to Native Americans. And so it's really something that crosses all cultural boundaries. It's very human. It can take many different forms. Obviously, some people like it more than others.
And do it more than others as well.
Yes.
How would you define what a pun is?
Well, puns are a subset of wordplay, and puns can take many different forms, from the spoonerism to the Tom Swifty to a Wellerism. But the most common type of pun, what we think of as a pun, is when one uses a word in such a way that due to its sound, it can be interpreted in more than one way. So bears go barefoot would be an example of that, because bear and bear sound exactly alike, but they have different spellings and different meanings.
Now, you're a champion. How does a pun championship work?
Well, the O. Henry World Championship Pun Off takes place every May in Austin, Texas, and it's set up like a tournament. So you're paired with an opponent in a bracket, and there's a judge and a timekeeper.
Right.
They pick a topic, and you've got 5 seconds to make a pun on that topic. And then your opponent has 5 seconds, and you go back and forth at 5-second intervals until someone chokes. Or you go the full 7-minute round and you're still tied, then it goes to the audience for a vote on quality. If I can give you an example or
go
two,
ahead.
I was paired with a former champion in the first round, bad draw. And I was so nervous because I had flown down there from Michigan and he
feeling
was
feeling kind of pumped, right?
Well, I was doing it on a lark almost because I had heard about this championship and I was pretty good at it, mm-hmm. so why not? And I used up my frequent flyer miles and I flew down. And this guy was so confident, and I was just hoping I didn't choke in the first 5 seconds and have wasted my frequent flyer miles on a 5-second embarrassment. And they picked the topic, and it's air vehicles. And I said, well, I hope I pick the right flying machine. And the judge says, son, you got to make a pun. And I said, W-R-I-G-H-T, I hope I pick the right flying machine. And the crowd cheers, and it was sort of like Rocky landing a first punch against Apollo Creed, and they knew that the brawl was on.
And you won.
I won. This guy was great, though. I mean, he said, I'm going to be 52 next week, so I'm never going to see 47 again. And I said, well, I'm going to be 29 next week, so I'm never going to be 17 again. And he said, oh, you're just up here winging it. And I looked at him and said, you too?
Oh, dear.
So,
oh, dear.
It wasn't all of that caliber. I scraped the bottom of the barrel many times. But eventually,
well, that's punning, isn't it?
Yeah, that's punning. It's a trial and error.
But you also talk about, and this is, I guess, taking this sort of ancient punning and putting it into the 21st century, which is a kind of hyperlink, the idea of that this is a kind of an intellectual hyperlink that takes place.
Absolutely. People often kick around the pun as low humor, that the intellectual gymnastics, that the physiological gymnastics that the brain has to go through to interpret incoming sound waves and attach meaning to it when that could be confusing, there could be many meanings, is really complex. And so we should respect the pun.
But we don't. I mean, generally speaking, someone puns and there's the eye roll, the groan. I'm sure you're used to that by now. Why doesn't a pun get the respect that you think it deserves?
Well, maybe a little later we can talk about the times when puns do get respect, right? Because in many contexts they do. We just don't think of them as puns necessarily, but they are. But the pun being kicked to the curb of humor really happened in the last 300-400 years, and there are a couple of causes for that. One was the rise of the printing press, which forced an oral culture to become a print culture. When you have a print culture, you got to choose a spelling,
right,
and favor a meaning, and you kind of suck out the ambiguity that fuels a pun. And another big reason was the Enlightenment, the rise of scientific reason, tended to favor rationality, clarity, specificity, and anything that was ambiguous and that resisted classification and containment was marginalized. Puns being ambiguous were marginalized because of it.
I have a feeling that they're coming back, and you include a lot of, you know, kind of punnish names that are used for stores and products and things like that are actually quite playful.
Yes, indeed. In fact, we're in a pun renaissance right now. And part of the reason for that is that there's so much information competing for people's attention,
yes,
that marketers and speakers, et cetera, are looking for ways to pack more information into fewer words. And puns are a great way to do that because you layer on meanings and they're sticky. They capture your attention and force you to double back and think, hey, did I catch what that person really meant?
Yeah.
And that's a very powerful tool in a noisy information environment.
So you live at the right time, right?
I live in the right time. I was just reading in the paper this morning, the sports section, about a three-peat. A three-peat, of course, is a pun.
Right.
It's a portmanteau pun.
And what do you mean by a portmanteau pun?
Where half the word means one thing and half the word means another thing. Put together, it combines the two concepts in one, which is what the first puns did 35,000 years ago.
Well, in fact, can we go back that far and find the first pun, do you think?
Absolutely. And this is so fascinating because the first hard evidence of a pun is a stone-carved statuette about the size of an Oscar that was found in the caves of Europe, several examples of them, One side is a naked woman, rotated 180 degrees. The other side is a phallus. And what it shows is that people could conceive of two opposites united in one, and what you saw depended on how you looked at it. In essence, it was the first cheeky double entendre.
Well, I was going to say, and a visual pun at that.
And
right?
A visual pun at that, yes.
And have people lost their lives over a pun?
Yes. Oliver Wendell Holmes aside, there have been a lot of punning duels over the course of history in ancient Babylon. In fact, the records show that princes would have these riddling duels that often turned on punning answers, and a wrong answer could lead to conflict and escalate to warfare between clans.
Would change the pun off, wouldn't it?
That would make it considerably higher stakes. And what's interesting is that crosses culture too, because Polynesian legend also contains riddling duels that turn on puns, and the penalty for getting a wrong answer would be dismemberment.
You had mentioned Tom Swifties. Obviously, Tom Swifties play an interesting role in this whole sort of wordplay. Can you talk about that?
There's a whole series of many, many Tom Swift adventure books. And to avoid repetitive language, the ghostwriters who churned these out by the dozens threw in funny twists. So, for example, "My shirt needs pressing," the bare-chested man observed ironically. "I definitely need another load of mulch," the gardener repeated.
Like Pete Moss, right?
Yep. "I absolutely love ribbons," the beauty queen said with abandon, with a band on.
A band on.
"Next time I should probably use a chair to fend off Leo," the lion tamer sighed offhandedly. So some of these have bites, some of them don't.
Right. Well, and spoonerisms, and I guess there's some debate about who actually said, "I'd rather have a bottle in front of me than a frontal lobotomy." And I always thought that was W.C. Fields, but you say maybe yes, maybe no?
Right. All the good ones, there are many authors. The bad ones, no one claims. Right. And what's interesting is that when Cicero was collecting puns for his pun book, which is now lost to history, right, the good ones he claimed and the bad ones he denied. So whatever was going around Rome at the time, he claimed authorship of the funny and declaimed the rest.
Thomas Jefferson apparently was unhappy about the amount of punning that was going on in this city more than 200 years ago.
Yes. In fact, this was a great discovery. I had been holed up doing research at the New York Public Library, and online I came across a collection of his letters, and he wrote to Abigail Adams, "The most remarkable effect of this convention as yet is the number of puns and bon mots it has generated. I think were they all collected, it would make a more voluminous work than the encyclopedia. This occasion, more than anything I have seen, convinces me that this nation is incapable of any serious effort but under the word of command. The people at large view every object only as it may furnish puns and bon mots, and I pronounce that a good punster would disarm the whole nation were they ever so seriously disposed to revolt."
A man after your own heart, yes?
Well, listen, it's good to know that the founding fathers were punsters.
And you were a speechwriter for President Clinton. Were you ever able to convince him to pun or to work a pun into one of the speeches that you wrote for him?
Well, he had such a great natural sense of humor, so he would often work humorous asides into speeches. As a general rule, I did not attempt to slip anything into presidential speeches.
Were you tempted, though?
There are a lot of cooks in the kitchen. It's a pretty serious business in most cases, what you're writing about, so we try and be careful. Right. But I will say this, is that he really appreciated puns, and in fact, I got the job as a speechwriter in part for having won the World Pun Championship.
Really?
I had been working on the Hill, and I had tried several times to get into the White House and kept missing. Other people were getting the job. And finally, an opening came up, and I was up against a speechwriter from the Pentagon who had more years of experience and in some ways was better connected. He's at the Pentagon.
Right.
It came down to the two of us, and the president circled on my resume that I had been world pun champion, wrote good in the margin, and I got the job. So it couldn't have hurt.
Now, do you have friends or family that know you well that do try to limit the amount of punning that you might do in a day?
I think that my friends have found it to be a contagious disease. Because
they've started punning themselves.
Even people who weren't punsters start to think that way and make puns too. But I try and show judgment, because I always say that puns make great appetizers. They're not so good as a main course.
And they can be a conversation stopper, I have to say.
Yeah, in the wrong moment, absolutely. So you need to choose your shots carefully.
Well, I'm curious about how you prepared for this pun off. I mean, do you have a punning partner for something like that?
Well, my dad is a great punster.
Is he?
And so we did a lot of punning over the years around the dinner table. When I found out about this contest, it was only 10 days away, and I got the last spot. So I just practiced with him to get a sense of 5 seconds, because usually—
That's pretty quick.
It's pretty quick, and the challenge of the pun championship is that you've got to stay on topic. One of the wonderful things about punning in general is the free association that it evokes. But in this case, you've got to stay on topic, and that can be tricky sometimes.
And you also have a section in the book about Jewish humor, and I don't know whether there's something about ethnic humor that certainly can be about wordplay, and whether there's something about the kind of humor we associate with Woody Allen, which certainly includes wordplay, but also puns as well.
Yes, and what's interesting is that a lot of different cultures pun. Jewish culture is very rich in puns because from the very beginning, it has been about closely looking at text and closely analyzing sounds of letters and looking at different meanings. That's why you see so many puns in the Old Testament and in the Talmud. And then that influenced Jewish comedy and then American comedy, because so many of the early 20th century comics were Jewish. What's interesting about Woody Allen is that he loves wordplay and language and punning. But he was actually a comic when he was getting started in the 50s, kind of pulled the rug out from under puns as humor moved away from the set piece humor that kind of steered around taboos and started talking about dysfunction and sex and drugs. And that kind of marooned the pun as an older form. And that's when the groan really started to kick in, as post-war, with Lenny Bruce and Woody Allen, et cetera.
This gets back to where we started, but I want to understand your brain a little bit better. But so when you're, let's say, on a train or listening to people talk or walking down the street or watching TV or reading the newspaper, are you then taking that language and turning it on its head, inverting it, playing with words, turning them upside down? Is that how your brain works?
Yeah, it's almost constant. And I'm just playing with the sounds like a couple of smooth pebbles in my hand, just kind of rolling them around, seeing how they fit together and roll together and how you could recombine them.
Do you think there's any, and I don't mean to be the diagnostic here, but that there might be a connection between attention deficit disorder and punning? And by that I mean in the best sense of the word, which is that ADD people are constantly sort of monitoring and analyzing the world that they live in.
That's a good question. I'm not sure about that, because I don't know enough about ADD. But I will say that this process of disassembly and reassociation is something that is intrinsic to all human creativity. And the people who first banged two rocks together to create a spark and said, what if I put some dry grass next to that and lit a fire? And, I can boil water. Oh, I can generate electricity. Mm-hmm. And suddenly we've got an iPhone. And it all started with banging two rocks together. And this banging of rocks together is essentially the banging together of two disparate ideas that don't seem associated. Mm-hmm. And then you get a plus. Now, are there a lot of associations that come to nothing? All the time. Science is full of it. Puns are, they're bad puns and good puns, but this is the creative process, trial and error. That's why we do it, I think.
That was punster John Pollock, who joined me in 2011 to discuss his book, The Pun Also Rises, How the Humble Pun Revolutionized Language, Changed History, and Made Wordplay More Than Some Antics. That does it for this edition of Radio Times in Review. Thanks for listening. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week.